What is up, guys, and welcome to Ace Weekly. This is Andrew Evans, and I am your host. We want to give you a warm welcome if this is your first time tuning into the show. Ace Weekly is a personal development, business, and entrepreneurship podcast where we release an episode each and every single week to help equip you with the skill set needed to be successful. Ace Weekly is all about how to become the ace that it is in your life, so how to up-level your game and how to find deeper meaning and purpose in what it is that you are doing on a daily basis. So doesn't matter who you are or what it is that you do, the habits of success are universal. So I know that we are excited to have you guys listening and tuning into the show today. And here's why. Our goal with this movement is to impact as many people as possible. And so here's what I ask. If you take away any value today from the show, share that value with somebody else. Meaning, if you listen to this show today and you are impacted in some way, or you find some sort of nugget that you can take back to your business or back to your life, don't just listen to that, take that information and do nothing with it. Go out and not only implement it into your own life, but go share that value with somebody else. Whether that is, you know, giving us a review or sharing us on social media or even reaching out to someone that you care about and let them know how this could impact their life. The goal of this podcast is to impact the world, and we can only do that if we are expanding the reach of this movement. Now, today, we're going to be talking about sales, and I'm really, really excited. We're sitting here in beautiful, sunny San Francisco. And across from me right now, I have Ian Koniak. And Ian is an awesome guy. I've really, really been looking forward to doing this interview with him. A little bit of background on Ian. He's had a lot of success in almost everything that he's done. When he was at Ricoh as a top sales performer there, he won President's Club 9 years in a row. From there, he's run a sales team with over 80-plus employees doing over $60 million a year in yearly revenue and business. And so he's someone that has experience not just there, but in multiple industries with a high level of success and a very high track record. After several years at Ricoh, he transitioned over to Salesforce, which is one of the fastest-growing, hottest companies, I think, and really the sales world and just in general today in our country. And the past 2 years, he's been the top 10 in the company. He was actually number one last year. And at Salesforce, he's sold more than anyone else in Enterprise Select in the past 2 years out of over 35,000 plus employees that work there now. Aside from all of his sales success and the value that he's going to be able to bring to you guys today, Ian is just a guy that has a ton of passion for helping others. And rather than just taking his own success and running with it, I know that he's someone that's really excited about pouring that out to other people, becoming a leader in his company, a leader in his family, and a leader for his community, and really sharing that knowledge and some of the skill set and the life lessons that he's been able to learn and giving that to other people. So, Ian, we're really excited to have you on the show. Welcome, man.
Great to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
Looking forward to it. So, I'm really, really excited. I want to dive right in here, some of the juicy stuff. I know that you've got an awesome story that I'm excited to talk about, but let's start off by just taking me back to when you were younger, growing up. I knew you grew up in California, right?
Yep, in Los Angeles.
Okay. What was it like for you, like, growing up?
It was great. I think growing up, things always came pretty easy to me. I was definitely not so challenged in high school and even college, and was always really trying to find my way, and because things were easy for me, I didn't have to study that hard in school. I definitely partied a lot, did a lot of sports. I played competitive tennis growing up. I got into a great school, UC Berkeley, finished with a 3.4 GPA, and never really had to work, which, you know, caused me to, you know, really want to explore the world and led me on a certain path of traveling from a very early age.
Did you grow up with any siblings or?
Yeah, I grew up with older brother Aaron. He's four years older than me.
Okay, awesome. And then you said mom and dad. So like when you were growing up, obviously, I don't know, were your parents pretty decently successful? If you didn't have to really work for much, or just you were just went out there and were successful because it kind of came naturally to you?
I think I was just blessed with being smart. School came very easy to
okay.
me. So I when I say successful, I got pretty good grades, got into good school, and really just didn't have to work that hard growing up. And so I mention that because sales has always been a lot of work, and it was a different challenge for me when I started entering the real world versus just school and college. My parents were actually separated from a young age. So I grew up with my mom and my stepdad, and then my dad lived in New York. So my mom took me and my brother to California from a very young age, and that's where I grew up. And my mom was a professor at UCLA, and she was a very, very successful, hard worker and kind of, you know, brought up initially as a single mom in California, which was always inspiring for me. And then my dad was in New York, a dentist. So I come okay. from great family. Education was always emphasized. And
what did your mom teach?
She teaches maternal nursing at UCLA. So she's an endowed chair over at UCLA. She's still there. She's about to retire. Finally, you know, I think she's turning 70 this year.
Awesome.
And, you know, she's awesome.
That's awesome. I can tell just by the light up on your face that you obviously have a good relationship with mom.
Big inspiration. And my dad also was a great inspiration for me growing up. I didn't see him as much. I traveled to New York in the summer and wintertime, but he died, unfortunately, when I was only 19 years old. And that was very hard for me, but he was always an inspiration. I always loved to see him when I visited in the summer and winter.
Now, that was probably what? That was when you were just transitioning into college?
Yeah, I was 19 years old. I was a sophomore year in college when he passed.
Mm. What was that like? Like how was that handling that while you were in school? Obviously, sounds like you did all right, you know, finishing up school there. But what was it like dealing with that while you're, you know, trying to carve your own way out in college?
It was really hard. It was very unexpected. He passed in his sleep. He was only 53 years old, and it really did shape how I've kind of shown up and how I've chosen the choices I made to live my life. My dad had health issues. He had hypertension, diabetes. He had struggled with his health issue, and unfortunately, a lot of the men in my family just haven't had long life. Even my cousin died at 47. So I've always been very, very aware of my genes and always kind of have to be very cautious of the choices I make, because I know that, that life is fleeting and short. So it's really impacted me in a, I think, a very positive way. But obviously, of course, losing your anyone is tough. Losing your father is especially tough. But it just made me really aware of kind of my genes and my health, and really impacted some of the choices I make in terms of exercise, diet, and just how I take care of myself.
Mm. Now you're in college. What were you studying in school?
I studied psychology.
Psychology. Okay. How did you make that transition there from you're in school, college, psychology? When did you transition over to the sales world?
Yeah, so interesting story. I didn't know I wanted to be in sales. I studied psychology because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. Really, I wanted to party when I was in college. Berkeley is a very academic school. Everyone's studying. It's tough. And so obviously there wasn't a ton of alignment there. So I went to go study abroad. I lived in Australia for a year, and I studied marine biology and Aboriginal anthropology, and was really just there to have fun. And it opened me up to travel. And so when I graduated from Berkeley, I said, you know, I'm not ready for the real world yet. I don't know what I want to do. So I took off, and this was right after 9/11. This was about 10 days before 9/11. My mom was begging me not to go. She was practically bribing me not to go, because we didn't know if there would be a war or what would happen. And I had already been set up to go teach English in South America. And so I lived for a year in Venezuela before I ever even got into sales teaching English. So,
okay. So you're studying psychology, you go around, travel the world. Now, did you travel before you moved to Venezuela?
I had been traveling. So when I went to, after I graduated college, I went to Europe. I visited 10 countries, backpacked. And then right after I got back, it was, I think, a week or two, I was back in the U.S. Then I went off to Venezuela. So I didn't have much of a break between graduation to Europe to Venezuela. It was like 10 days at home. So it was pretty continuous. And even before Europe, I had been living in Australia for a year studying abroad. So I had spent a good, you know, 2 years and in a month traveling prior to actually starting sales once I came back from Venezuela.
Gotcha. And so you're in Venezuela now. You're teaching. Where did that come from, by the way? You're studying psychology. Was that something that you had in your plan, or like you just kind of said, like, screw it, I'm going to go teach?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a program through Berkeley that lets you, for people who want to travel and they don't know what they want to do, they'll set you up with a job. So you can work on a farm, you can go teach, you can pretty much go anywhere in the world. It's called ISEC. And, you know, Miles was part of that program as well. He ran at USC.
Yep.
And I found it out through Berkeley, and they said you can pick your country. It was either Brazil or Venezuela. I chose Venezuela because I wanted to learn Spanish, not Portuguese. And basically, they sent me there, and I truly did not know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to travel and experience the world from a very young age, but I had absolutely no intention or plans of going into sales at that point.
Now, let me ask you this, because I know obviously you're passionate about what you do now, and yep. I know... As we dive into this a little bit more, work ethic is a foundation for a lot of the success that you've had. For someone that is in a similar situation, right? There's a lot of young listeners on the show. They're getting ready to graduate college. And quite frankly, they're just really not sure what the heck they want to do or what direction they should go in life. I know there's contrasting viewpoints on this, right? A lot of people, I hear people like Gary Vee, you know, go out there like, you have so much time, go out there, experience the world, you know, you have so much time. And there's other people who are like, no, like you need to go out there and like start hustling and put some work in and start developing some skill set. What's your thought process on that? Because I can see how you could value both.
I would say I would agree with Gary Vee. If you have the opportunity to travel, for me, it was the experiences. You think about growth. Where does growth occur? Growth occurs when you're uncomfortable, when you have new experiences, when you're thrown into an environment and you need to either sink or swim. So maybe it sounds fun, but the reality is I didn't know a lick of Spanish. I arrived in a country, I didn't know a single person, and I knew I was going to be there for a year. So the opportunity to literally learn a new language, live with a family, get truly immersed with another culture every single day, every week, every month was an amazing new experience in Venezuela. And the growth I had there gave me the confidence, gave me the self-assuredness to really come back and crush it in sales when I did finally leave. So I would encourage anyone that has the opportunity to travel or do something while they're young, you know, to experience that, because those experiences are being married now and having a three-year-old. I can tell you, I can't go away for a year and teach English in Venezuela. So
right.
I truly do, you know, believe that you don't want to just jump in, because if unless you have those experiences, you may not put everything that you can into your job when you actually do start working, and you want to be in a place where you can give it your all. So if you still have an itch or desire to do something different, try it out, see where it lands, and the worst that can happen is you grow and you experience and you fail and you learn from it. So
that's awesome. Something I want to differentiate there too, the advice that you're giving is different than like, hey, you got so much time in the world, go out and have fun. It's like, hey, you have a lot of opportunities to make mistakes, so go out and put yourself in environments that challenge you. It's not like you just were like going out. Well, I mean, I understand there was a little bit of partying there.
It was Venezuela, I'll just be clear. So what I was doing there, right, I was learning a language. Every day I was journaling, I was writing, I was doing photojournalism. So I would go all around. When I wasn't teaching, I was traveling around the country, visiting some of the most beautiful places in the world. Angel Falls, Canaima National Park, that's the highest waterfall in the world. Every single weekend was an adventure. I would go camping. I went to 2 weeks to trek in Guyana with native Guyanans. I wasn't just sitting around partying. I was having experiences that filled my cup that I am so blessed and fortunate to have had in that time. So I would say, you know, from that perspective, the growth in the learning that I had there just from traveling, learning photography, writing, learning Spanish was probably as big of a growth as any year I've experienced, even in sales or not in sales.
That's awesome. Now, you're there teaching Spanish. How many years were you there?
I was there for 1 year.
Okay. what happened? What made you transition back to the States?
So the way I got into sales is I ended up falling in love, heavily in love, with one of my students at the time. Now, this was an adult school, so it was kids, adults. It was nothing like that. But, you know, I was 23 years old, and we really were in love, and she was 18. And basically, the only way that we were going to continue the relationship was either if I stayed in Venezuela or if I came back to the U.S. and she got a visa to come here. And the only visa she could get, because she wasn't a professional and she was young, was a student visa. So I knew that in order to continue this relationship, I would have to make enough money to bring her to the U.S., pay for her college, and support us both from a very young age, living in an apartment together. And I had zero money. I'd spent all of it.
What am I going to do now?
Yeah, I said, what am I going to do now? So I was in a career fair for sales and marketing. And I remember there was the flyer, and it said, make $75,000 your first year, $100,000 your second year, and, you know, $150,000 plus your third year. And I'm like, oh my God, what do I have to do? And they said, you just do what we say you need to do, and the rest will take care of itself. If you follow, you know, what we tell you, and you just do it, I promise you, you'll be successful. And that's how I originally got started selling copiers door to door.
Right. And so it sounds like, I mean, even you were always a good student in taking like what you learned and applying it and just soaking it all in.
Yep.
And taking that stuff up. So is that when you started working with Ricoh? Or
that's when I started working. At the time, it was a company called Lanier, and then Ricoh bought them, I think, in 2007.
How old were you?
I was 23 at the time.
Okay, so you're 23. Did you have a lot of initial success when you started, or what was that like?
Well, I didn't, actually. I did not know what I was doing. I had zero sales experience, but I just knew why I was doing it, which is one of the most important things. I'd encourage anyone for, you know, new to sales, is know why you're doing, because sales, especially doing door-to-door or, you know, more of a transactional sale, it is a grind. It's activity-based. The more people you talk to, the more at-bats you get. And I was very much, you know, selling copiers and printers. There's not much purpose there, right? You're it's not a sexy item as Salesforce is, or other products or services. So for me, it was just truly a matter of diving headfirst in and making a lot of mistakes. And I had a lot of faith in myself. And more importantly, I had a mentor and coach. His name was Tim Harris. And he assured me that if I did what he said that, you know, I needed to do, that I would be on my path to success. Initially, it was very hard. I had the Koreatown territory, and many people did not
speak Korean.
I don't speak any Korean. I spoke Spanish. That did not come in handy for this territory.
You should have just gone to Korea.
Yeah, apparently so. I was thrown out of buildings. I was chased by security guards. I mean, it was brutal in the beginning, and I literally did not know what sales was. I remember printing a flyer with like all the copy machines and a price next to it, like $2.99 a month, $300 a month, $400 a month, and I'd hand them out, and I thought that was sales, and obviously didn't work very well. But top it off, after like, I think it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks in the job, I broke my arm snowboarding and had to go on medical leave. So that really set me back, where I was out for 2.5-3 months before I can get back working. So initially it was a ton of setback, and no one thought I was coming back from medical leave. They said, this guy's history, he's not coming back. And so,
right.
But I was on a mission, because I wanted to get this woman from Venezuela over, and I knew I had, the only way to do it was to be successful in my job. So I was very driven.
And so eventually you did?
Yeah. So after my first year, basically what happened is my boss said, Ian, the key to sales, it's a science. If you set up enough appointments, you will, even if you suck, even if you're terrible, if you meet with 10 people per week, out of those 10, there are 4 people who are going to take a proposal, right? 6 are going to say, you know, timing's not right. 4 of those people are going to want to see a proposal, right? That's the natural ratios that we have. And out of those 4, if you're a terrible salesperson, you'll sell 1 deal out of the 4. You'll close 25%. So all you need to do is set 2 appointments every day and 10 appointments a week. And when we go on our ride day together, I want you to stack 6 appointments in a row. I want you to put everyone, and I'll show you how to do the job, and I'll go out with you, and I'll show you how to close business. And so all I cared about was setting up that ride day, filling up with appointments. And I watched, and I learned, I took notes. And after probably 3 or 4 months, I was out selling on my own, and the rest is really history.
It's awesome. So you're there now. At what point did you start moving up in the company? You're going out there, so you started crushing sales. Yeah. You moved your girlfriend at the time up to the States.
Yeah.
Right.
So I moved my girlfriend. We were, you know, putting her through college, and then that needed me to continue making money. So at that point, my boss said, you know, Ian's really good. I think I'm going to give him a better territory than Koreatown, because, you know, the woman who was in Santa Monica at the time, and if you know Santa Monica, it's a lot of tech companies, a lot of startups, and
right.
It was like the hot territory. And I said, I raised my hand. I said, I've earned it. And he said, no. And I said, yes, I've earned it. And so finally he gave me the Santa Monica territory. And basically when I went there, this was 2003. And between 2003 and 2007, I was staying as an individual contributor selling in Santa Monica. So my first year, I had made $95,000. My second year, I made almost $200,000. And then it continued from there. And in selling copiers, people said, how the heck is it possible? I remember my last year in individual contributor role, I made between $300,000 and $400,000. I was 26 years old at the time. And I'm like, right. I was just, and then I broke up with my girlfriend. Unfortunately, it was a very, very bad, devastating breakup. And that kind of shattered my view of the world. And I had all this money and didn't know what to do with it. And so things kind of took a rocky turn from there. But ultimately, I decided that sales, I was not challenged anymore in sales. I experienced peak growth. And that's when I decided to go into management and took on a team of my own. And that was initially started with 7 and grew ultimately to 80 employees and 10 teams when I decided to leave back in 2013. And that's a whole different, you know, whole
right.
different story there.
Now, you get into management, which I think is important for people to hear too, because the two skills in my mind that I'm always talking about, and I've heard other people say this too before, sales and leadership.
Yep.
And I think both fuel each other, but they are two different skill sets.
Yep.
What was that like? You've rocked the sales world for a little bit. Now you move into management, because I know this is a problem for a lot of people. They'll go and crush it in the sales industry for 10, 15 years. They get into a management role and they're like, oh, I suck at this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, oftentimes in a lot of companies, it's up or out too. So once they promote you up, they don't usually move you back down sometimes. So what was that like, that transition to move into the managerial role? And like, what were some of the lessons that you learned there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me, the biggest lesson, the sign of a good, there's a difference in a manager and a coach. For me, I was not a manager. I was a coach. And my mantra is help people get what they want and you will get what you want. And I still live by that in sales and management. And so my team, I remember there was a guy, Matt Yarte. There was a guy, Michael Aguilar. There was John Bustos. I remember the team. That was probably two of the best years of my life, is running a team. Because the way I ran it, I said, guys, you stick with me and you will be successful. Just like Tim talked to me and said, I'll show you the ropes. And I had faith in him. They trusted me. And I said, all you got to do is line up your ride day. So the way I viewed my sales job was, or a sales manager job was, really, I need to lead by example. I need to be in the field with them every day. I need to put money in their pockets, help them be successful, understand what they want. And it was so fulfilling to be a manager. That sales manager frontline job probably was the most reward I've ever felt in any position in my career, was leading that team.
And it's awesome that you put it that way too, because I think that's a big differentiation between people that are successful and aren't in any leadership capacity, like if you're a manager or you're a CEO of a company or anything like that too. If you talk to anyone, right, they'll all say something similar, meaning that like, the way I do better at my job is by making sure that you all do better at your job. When your number one goal and mission is your people, and your goal is to go out there and serve them on a daily basis, and like that, you talked about why earlier, that's why you show up. That's why you do what you do on a daily basis. And like, your goal is to just make them as successful as possible. That's when you start performing at a high level, right? Like, you go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. We had so much fun. I like to say, the best boss I ever worked to, kudos to my boss, Dallas Stonis. I've worked for him for 3 years. He's made me so much better in how I sell. And it's because he's going and he's rolling up his sleeves and he's out there grinding with me. He's working on deals with me. He's in front of my customers. There's a difference between a leading by example and doing versus leading from what I call an armchair manager position, where it's just, you know, picture guy with a big desk and just looking at reports and spreadsheets, telling people what to do. Those kind of managers are really useless. You got to add value to your people. You got to show them. And the best way to show them is to do and to be successful doing. So if you're going to be a manager, make sure you know how to do the job that your team is doing first.
And that's the one thing that is congruent, I think, between sales and the management aspect of it too. And it's just that the more people that you help, the more money you make.
That's right.
Right. And I think that especially today, we have a lot of people that think there's, you know, like the fixed pie. And it's like, hey, if someone else is making more money, that means I'm losing money. Or, you know, it's like a maybe a win-lose. Maybe, hey, I win. Maybe you win too.
That's right.
You know, here we're talking about co-creation. And you know, like I heard just a quote. It's like, hey, you get paid in value to the complexity of the problems that you solve, or you get paid. The more money that you make is the more people you help, which is awesome too. That we live in a world like where that is the case, because I think 50 years ago, 75 years ago, there's a lot of people out there making a lot of money that necessarily wasn't the case. But you know, we have like people have enough information now. There's not information asymmetry. Like there's not a lot of companies out there scamming people. You're a company and you go out and scam people with some kind of product, or you're a crappy salesperson, like people will know right away and you'll lose business. So it's awesome that we live in a world now where even you in the sales industry, it's like, hey, the more people I help, the more impact I make in the world, the better off I am too. And I get to benefit some of the rewards of being more valuable to other people.
Yeah, that's why I'm excited to be on your podcast, is just take what's in my head and my heart and just share it and help people be successful. Because I think sales management, the industry of sales in general, offers just an opportunity. I'm living proof that it's unlimited potential in this business. If you work hard, you have the skill, you work on yourself, and you have the right purpose.
Awesome, man. Now you're there crushing it, right? So you start doing really well in management too.
Yep.
And at what point, because that is this is also something that I think a lot of people experience at one point or other in their careers, where they've had a lot of success in one industry. And I think it's like something that I'm noticing about you, Ian, is that you always like shoot your shot. Like you see an opportunity and you go out there and like you run with it. And this is something we were talking about earlier too. Like you probably didn't even notice it very much earlier, but you were talking about, hey, like the Santa Monica territory. There's a lot of other people that would have been like, hey, you know, like, oh, I'll take that. And they're like, oh, no, you're not ready for it. It's like, oh, okay, I guess. Yeah. But you're like, no. Like, hey, give it to me. Give it to me. Give me a shot. Let me take my shot. Right. And then so now you're here. You have all this success at Rico. And you see another opportunity, but obviously it's taking a leap. You're going from one place where you know you've experienced a lot of success. You have a track record. There's some security there. And now you kind of jump out into the world of the unknown. You leave, go to Salesforce, tech sales. It's just a completely different industry, completely different probably style of sales. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously security there, but not probably what you were earning originally at your other company. What was going through your head, and what helped you with that transition there?
Yeah. So the reason I left Rico, I think it was something that a lot of people were very surprised, because when I left, I was in a director of sales position. I was running a big organization. I had a lot of employees that depended on me. And I remember we were using Salesforce at the time. We were a customer. And this was when I first started being in management. It was 2008, 2009-ish. I got hired at the end of 2007. So right when I got hired as a sales manager, the recession hit. Boom. And everybody, so you got to remember, this is a recession, right? No one's spending money. People are laying off employees. The Great Recession. You were probably too young to experience that firsthand, but I was smack in the middle of it in a new job in an industry that was really kind of a dying industry. Rico was trying to reinvent themselves, but people don't print with the environment, with iPads. The iPhone came out in 2009. More and more applications were being developed, and printing, copying, traditional paper output was not the method of sharing information in the digital world. And I saw that at the time. And I knew during this recession, I grew my business by 30% while Rico was actually flat or declining across the board. So how did I do that? It was this amazing software called Salesforce, combined with me implementing processes that I could use. That's key: people, process, and technology. The technology piece I had the people and the process. So I used Salesforce to run my reports. I said, here's the activity all of us need to do to be successful. And I literally ran and grew my business, kept getting promoted because I had a very, very scalable model of how to hire and make each person successful using Salesforce. And I tracked all that. And I said, man, if I can do this in the recession in an industry that's going downhill, there's something here. I could sell this all day long. Cause as a customer, I have proof that this works. I can call in VPs of sales. I can call in people that are trying to grow the revenue and show them how Salesforce can be impacted. That was always in my head. Then I read an article in Forbes magazine. This was 2012, it came out, and it said the average account executive at Salesforce in the enterprise space was making over $300,000. Now, I had been number one director of sales at Rico, and I think I made $240,000 my last year there. And yeah, maybe that sounds good on paper, but I'm number one with a team of 80, $60 million business making $240,000. And the average individual contributor at Salesforce is making over $300,000. I said, what gives here? And what I realized is I was playing in the wrong sport entirely. I needed to get where software as a service is. and just to give you some perspective, it was the right bet. It was the best move I ever made, because at the time I joined Salesforce, that was 2013, we were under $3 billion in revenue, and now we're on track to, you know, at the end of this year, I think we're $13 billion now, and we'll be targeting to do over $15 billion. We've been continuing to grow 20-25% every year. Despite our size, we're one of the fastest growing companies, and I've just kind of been along for the ride for the past 6 years. So just kind of knowing where the future is, you know, when you're stagnant, you know, when your industry stagnant, you know, when you're not growing anymore. And for me, it was a loud and clear calling that I was ready for the next phase of my journey.
Yeah. When you say, you know, you feel that in your gut.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I told you, I seized the next opportunity, and I just saw that. I knew, and I talked to people at Salesforce. There was a guy, Bruce Fiscus, who was working at Rico. He went over there. I talked to him. I said, is this true? Are the reps really doing it? They're like, yeah, you got to get over here. And now we're, again, I was under 10,000 employees. Now we're almost 40,000 employees. So
wow.
It's been a rocket ship. So,
and I think that's important too, that, like, again, going back to the shoot your shot, right? Like you acted on the knowing. I think a lot of people know, right? And they'll feel that feeling, and then they wait a year, they wait 2 years, they wait 5 years, they wait 10 years, and then they complain about the economy, or they complain about, oh, my industry is, you know, blah, blah. And you could have been the exact same situation too, but instead you took what you learned. You said, hey, here's my next opportunity. Here's my next move. I'm going to go out there. It's slightly a risk, you know, obviously jumping from what you had there. You know, now it makes perfect sense. And it was like, hey, that was the right decision. But at the time, I'm sure there was at least a little bit of uncertainty around it, even though in your gut, I know.
Yeah. What was really, I'll give a shout out to my manager who took a, you bet on people, right? You don't bet on results. You bet on people. They're driven people. You got it, Andrew. You've had it the moment I met you. There are people who have that drive, that over my dead body resolve, and they will not accept failure. And I just was fortunate. My mom's like that. There's just a lot of that in me. And I didn't have the experience going into Salesforce. I was selling hardware and shifting to software. It's a completely different sale. One's activity transactional. The other is very much strategic consultative. And so Grant Wood, who came from HP and was selling, you know, printing, he made the shift from printing to selling HP software. And he knew that he saw that opportunity in me and gave me the chance to be on his team without any sales experience. And he hired me into the enterprise level, which is the highest, hardest place to go, where people will spend 10 years to get to be an enterprise salesperson. I got started there. So it was a really hard transition, having, you know, done what I did for so long at Rico and then completely starting over at Salesforce as an individual contributor.
What were some of the challenges that you had when you were transitioning?
I think the biggest thing is I was trying to do things the same way I knew. So I was always coin-operated salesperson. My philosophy is activity equals pipeline equals results. And that is true in certain industries. It's true when it's a fast sale. It's true when it's not as strategic. With copiers, it was very much an ROI. We showed here's how much your printers, copiers, and scanners are costing, and here's how much your paper's costing, and I'll give you everything for a lower price, and it's a done deal.
ROI.
Really, really simple. You sell to the CFO, a couple meetings. Bigger deals take a little longer, but for the most part, it was a financial discussion, whereas with Salesforce, it was change, right? So when you buy software, you are fundamentally changing the way your employees work. You're changing the tools that they have, and I thought I can just get in front of as many people as possible and just pitch Salesforce, and they'd say, yay, this is a great product. You know, we want to use it. What I didn't realize when I underestimated is that culture and leadership and what's involved with selling software really is an emotional buy. It's a purpose-driven buy. It has nothing to do with the product and everything to do with, you know, where they want to take their company and how software will enable them to get there. And that was a completely new skill for me.
Now, so someone is new, and not necessarily, I think you could obviously speak a lot on tech, a lot on software. Someone in general starts new in an industry. What would you recommend? Like, what are some things that they need to do to, like, kind of hit the ground running there?
So I would say a few things, right? Number one is know your purpose, right? If you're in sales or you're an entrepreneur, start with your why. Understand exactly why you want to do it. So for me, you know, I gave the story of needing to make a certain amount of money. Love is one of the most powerful forces in the universe. So that was my why, and I had to be with her. And every cold call I make, it was easy because I knew it was going to lead to that.
Now, intuitively at that time, were you thinking, oh, this is my why, or was it just kind of like something that was subconscious?
No, I I knew every. In fact, I put a dollar amount on every cold call. I said every cold call I do is going to be $7. I backed into the number of cold calls it takes to set 10 appointments, to do 4 opportunities, to do 1 sale, and it came out to $7 per cold call. And that was a lesson that my my old boss, boss's boss, Dusty Lininger, taught me. He said, if I paid you $7 for cold call, how much could you do in a day? I said 100. I do 100 a day. He's like, so go do it, because then you'll meet that many more people. So it was very much a trust kind of issue. I would say for anyone new, you know, A, know your purpose, right? B, know your metrics. Know how many activities and what mix of activities you need to do to get in front of the right types of people to ultimately pitch or propose your product and service. And I would say number 3 is just work on your skills, right? Practice, 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 whether it's objection handling, closing, setting appointments, being able to review proposals, all the skills in between, referral generation, right? I was committed to my trade. And the 4th thing I would say is get a mentor. Have somebody who's successful in the role. Even to this day, I still have mentors that are helping me in Salesforce. Find someone who's doing the job, doing it really well, and be committed. I think people inherently, it's human nature to want to help and serve. And top performers, you know, a lot of people don't know what they're doing. So just, you know, approach the top performer or ideally your sales manager, your direct boss, and say, I want help. I'm willing to do whatever it takes, and you know, I'd love you to carve out time with me, go on my ride days, can I shadow you, whatever it is that is appropriate for your industry. I'd say those 4 things are going to be key for anyone new coming into any industry.
Yeah, like, and the key there's any industry. I don't even think this is like, this transcends beyond sales. I think you said some really killer things that some people, like if you're listening to this show right now, if you're driving, this is something that you would want to rewind and probably take notes on. So just rewinding for a second, you said 4 keys, right? Number 1, know your purpose, know your why, yep. Know the metrics, like know your numbers. That's something I talk about a lot on the show. There's so many people in sales, so many people in business that just like don't check the numbers. And something I was saying in a message that I gave to one of our companies is that like even the dude selling mangoes, you know, on the street, like knows how many mangoes he needs to sell that month in order to feed his family. Like that's if right. You are in business, you need to become a numbers person, even if you're not a numbers person. So knowing your numbers, developing your skill set, right? Developing a fine-tuned skill set, and then finding a mentor.
That's right.
Now, some of those things are easier said than done. When it comes to knowing your why, okay, for someone that doesn't have a girlfriend in another country that you're trying to bring over, or you know, they just graduated good from point. College. So, you know, I think that's actually a really good question to ask, because there's a lot of students that, you know, Simon's Next Talk, Find Your Why. I think that if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably already heard this like 3 or 4 times. And it's important, and I think that's why it keeps coming up. But what would you suggest to someone that's like, I don't know what my why is. I don't know what my purpose is. How do I go out there and find that? What would you say to them?
I would say it's okay. You don't have to know. I think it's really, really, Andrew, for me, the why shifts all the time, right? So last year, I live in Los Angeles. I own a condo in Marina Del Rey, and I wanted to move to the South Bay, which is Manhattan Beach, El Segundo, probably one of the most expensive areas in all of the U.S. To buy a house was going to be between $1.5 million and $2 million. And I was always telling my wife, we can't afford to live there. And I went back and I reset my why. And she said, well, you know, I don't know if I want to live in L.A. if we can't get the right type of house that is going to, you know, be good for our growing family. And that became my why, to make my wife happy, to give her the life of her dreams. And that was a new why. And sure enough, I had my best year with that as a reference point last year. That's when I sold almost $6 million at Salesforce individually. And we bought the house that we both love now, and we're raising our family. And so I would say just in general, I have some pretty extreme cases, certainly with Venezuela, but every year I try to reset my why. So don't look too far ahead, right? If you're young and you want to move out, buy a car, go in and really just prove to yourself or prove to others, or, you know, be the best person that you can be. Hone your skills. Go out and make the most of the gifts God's given you. You know, go out and like, it's pursuit of my full potential. That is always my why. So it doesn't have to be a thing or an object or a glaring need. That certainly helps. But I would say just the exercise of going through, you know, you talk about Simon Sinek and knowing your why. Read, that's a great book to read. But I think, you know, what is it that you want? Really think about what you want. And it's okay if it's material. It doesn't have to be love or a house or a family. Those things are, I think, really, really impactful. But just think about where you're at right now, where you want to go in the gap, and visualize you guys getting to that place, and really think about it, feel into it, and have that be your why. It doesn't need to be something like completely extreme, but I think most people do kind of know what they want and they know where they're at today. And there's probably a gap and having line of sight, even just 1 year at a time, is where I'd encourage people to start. And I'd say that it can apply to anyone, anywhere.
So powerful. Wow. You said pursuit of your potential.
Yes. So I heard this from a guy, Mike Kaur. I won't steal credit, but it's all, I believe in serendipity. Everything happens for a reason and people are there to help you. And there's messages that come all the time and you can listen or you can ignore. But after one of my hardest years in sales, I wasn't always successful in Salesforce. You said the past 2 years, but my first 4 years, I was kind of hovering at or around quota. And I had a massive shift in my identity 2 years ago when I joined Abundant, where I met you. And really, I met a guy named Mike Kaur, and I remember it was January 31st, and it was the very last day of our fiscal year, and I needed one more sale to hit my quota, and I missed it. And I was so devastated, and I said, something's got to give. I am, I think I finished 95% that year, and it was, it was fine. I made good money, but
so
I knew.
So you still did well, but you're still like, there's well, something more out
but
there.
But I said, I saw people killing it. I said, what the heck am I missing, right? And so that next day, we were out at a kickoff for the new year, and Mike Kaur, who was a VP at Salesforce, was telling me a story about his why and why he does what he does. And he's like, Ian, you need to find your why. And so this is a constant theme in life, is like recalibrating, resetting. And what he told me is, for me, happiness is the joy I feel in the pursuit of my full potential. And that really, really stuck with me, because in my mind, if you've been given gifts, if you've been given intelligence, if you've been given charisma, if you've been given even difficult situations, my father passing, everything could be viewed as a gift or a lesson. And the question is, what are you going to do with it? And for me, I was not living in my full potential. I was not doing my best. I was very money motivated. I was very material driven. And once I realized that there's a broader purpose, and that, my purpose was really using my gifts to serve others and be bigger than just me and my family, that's when I just started crushing it in sales. So Mike Kaur, shared that with me, that really stuck. And then within a couple of weeks, I joined the Epic Impact, now called Abundant. And that's all we work on, is, really your identity and your purpose in life. So it's been great, a couple of years since then.
Awesome. Earlier you mentioned mom kind of instilling that, like, do whatever it takes mentality into you. Where did that come from? Because obviously you said your mom. Was she born and raised in the U.S. or?
Yeah, she was born in New York.
Okay.
And working class family. Didn't have money growing up, right? And she had to work two jobs to raise me and my brother. And
she
had a tough separation from my father. And again, she moved. They were in New York, and they moved across the country when I was only 2 years old. And so she was single at the time. She was trying to take care of both of us. Very, very little money. And so she had to work to basically take care of her family. And my mom is so driven. She's the hardest worker I know. I really, truly am inspired to have her as a role model. And I think, she just always was all about education. We come from a Jewish family where education is really important in our family, both my parents. But my mom in particular was always extremely, hard worker. And ultimately, I was exposed to that growing up. I was exposed to the value of education, the value of hard work, and just kind of seeing, living with her and seeing her example and having, the ability to have her as a role model, and my dad too, but especially because I was being raised by my mom, it was extremely, extremely visible. It just instilled in me from a very young age that you can achieve whatever you want if you put your mind to it. Because my mom will be the first to tell you, like, she's not the smartest person in the room, right? She works hard, and she adds value, and she's committed to, always getting better. And it takes her a little longer to do things, but she works her butt off, and it's I don't see her retiring. She says she's going to, but I think she's gonna get bored. I think I don't ever see her completely stopping. But yeah, she's been great. Great inspiration.
That's awesome. Now you've obviously been killing it at Salesforce for a couple years now. What I think this is important to ask. I can't have one of the top performing salespeople here and not ask this question. What do you think is, because there's almost 35,000, 40,000, however many it is, people in your company, and there's a lot of salespeople out there in the world. There's a lot of amateurs. There's a few. There's select people that are really, really good at what they do. What do you think separates the people that are wildly successful from the people that are just average? And maybe your industry or just in general?
I think it's an in general question. I think people that are wildly successful have resilience. They don't give up. They can fail. I failed over and over again selling copiers, whereas the average person might give up or want to change industries and hop around jobs and find their way.
Yeah, what's the turnover rate there? How long does the average person last?
Gosh, it was almost 100% when I was there. I mean, we had new people every year. It was like a whole new team, right? And I kept my team. I kept my team the whole time I was there because they believed in what we were doing together. But I would say there's some inherent qualities. So one is just resilience, persistence, right? Number two is commitment to excellence, right? Top performers are never, ever, the true sign of a master is never seeing yourself as one. So the top people in Salesforce and Ricoh, they're always trying to hone their craft. They're learning the new products. They're learning new skills. They're engaging in Salesforce. It's a team sell. You bring in your team. We have engineers that help us. We have people that help us with business cases. We have people that help us tell stories and create visions and videos. I bring in the whole team because when you're selling, $8 million contracts, you're talking about massive, massive teams that have to approve this. And I can't do it all myself. I think the first 4 years in Salesforce, I was trying to do everything myself and I did fine. I did good. But once I brought in my team, once I really, collectively, there's a lot of brain power at Salesforce and probably in most companies for where people are listening today work. And you have to bounce ideas off people. You have to engage. People are there to help. People want to be seen and heard. And then you use your team to sell as a team, especially in software. And finally, just from a pure, I would say customer focus, right? I think the most successful people are truly focused on their customer success. Regardless of what you're selling, if your mission is to help a client, if your place of service and sales is truly to help people get what they want, then you're fine walking away. You're not attached to outcomes. If you can't help them in terms of doing business with them, a good, great salesperson will say, okay, I can spend my time with people that do want help. So I really do believe, the best salespeople aren't trying to push something that other people that their customers don't want. The best people are leading their customers to the desired destination, and they're just facilitating it. The customer's the hero. You're just helping them get there, right? You're introducing them and showing them a way that they weren't aware of, and so they're going to be forever grateful to work with you when you've shown them something they didn't know before they met you.
This is great, and again, like this is it, even if you're not in sales, if you're in sales, like you should take notes on this entire episode. So many more questions for you, Ian. We don't have too much more time, but I want to ask too, like you've experienced obviously a lot of success over the years. There's some people say success changes people, right? Or you get to a certain level and then you become someone different. What's your thought on that? And then like maybe what are some of your challenges as your skill set has gone up, as your income has increased? What are some of like the challenges that you faced along with that?
I think success could change people if you let it get to your head. But one thing I didn't mention is the top salespeople, you wouldn't know they're the top salespeople because they're humble. They're not going around and bragging about being the top people. They're truly helping and serving and they're very low key, right? It's that like that book, The Millionaire Next Door. Like you don't know they're millionaires because they're not in your face about it. People think salespeople are flashy and you look at me, I'm one of the guys. I am not. I'm here as part of crew. And it's just something that I see common. Like they're normal. Everyone's a CEO of a company is a human being. And above all else, it's about the human connection. So I think for people that let it go to their head, they're probably motivated by the wrong things. They're probably motivated by their ego or their income. And that's fleeting, right? When we die, it's what impact did we leave? What, how do we make the world better? In my mind, how do we serve our families? Did we do the best we can? And that to me took forever. So we talk about challenges that we've had, right? My biggest challenge is that success made me bored, right? Because I was very successful in what I did, I never really felt fulfilled. I was only as good as my income, right? I thought if I had a great year, then I was successful. And what I struggle with is I worked really hard and I partied really, really hard. And it got me to some really tough places where I would say I have struggled with addiction. And it's been something that I have to be very, very aware of. In my family, there's a history of addiction. And it's been it's just been really, I mean, from, you know, I won't get too detailed, but there's been a lot of alcoholism in our family. And I've had tendencies where even in myself, I know when I had a big, big month or big year, I'd go out and I'd drink. And you know, I went in 2006, I crashed into a tree head first, and I could have killed myself. I could have killed my best friend, and I had been drinking. And that's when I started going to therapy and really kind of acknowledging and really being aware of this tendency to like really celebrate hard. And I feel like, you know, for me, it's something, fortunately, it's been a long time, and I've made some choices, and I'm very conscious of my genes. And it's something you have to actively really be aware of, but I'm like anyone else, right? I struggle with tuning out. I struggle with, you know, wanting to celebrate with my family. I certainly now being a dad and husband, there's working very hard and not maybe having the balance with my family. I know my wife would love me to be around, you know, here, you know, in LA versus up in San Francisco doing sales trainings, but you really just kind of have to roll with the punches. And I would just say the biggest challenge is in life is not being aware of your weaknesses, right? The minute you know your weaknesses, the minute you know who you are, you can embrace and accept and start loving yourself despite, you know, your imperfections. So for me, my biggest challenge is just kind of really knowing who I am and making sure that I'm a little softer with myself. I'm a little more forgiving when I make mistakes, when I do things that maybe aren't in alignment with, you know, my ideal self. And that's something that even to this day, I'm very conscious of. And it's an active challenge for me.
Yeah. I think that there's a common theme going through our culture, you know, today, like self-love. And I think that, I feel like even to me too, when the first time I started hearing that, I'm like, you know, this is just like self-love stuff. That's kind of weird. But I think you raise a really good point, and that is that even some of the most successful people that you see, these CEOs of companies, like they're just people. They, you know, when they go home at the end of the night, like they sit there and they like, you know, I mean, they do the exact same thing that everybody else does. They're all people. And with that in the human condition, like everyone has weaknesses and everyone has crutches or things that they struggle with. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a combination of, like you said, developing the awareness of those weaknesses. But also I think too, like finding the grace for yourself, right? And finding like not like beating yourself up for it. And rather than, cause I think it's very, very easy. I mean, someone comes from a background of addiction or someone struggles with something or, you know, whatever, like whatever your weaknesses is, like a lot of people, number one, aren't aware of it. And the people that are aware of it, a lot of them, you know, it's even almost worse that they're aware of it because they just beat themselves up every single time and they have, right. It's harder for them to really, like I said, love themselves.
Yeah. You're hitting such an important point for me. It's just, you know, I'm a man of extremes, right? If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to go running every morning, I'm going to sell this much. When I say I had a period, I went to therapy for the better part of last year. And it's because I was like, why the hell am I acting out? Why do I get drunk, for example, when I'm going to celebrate? Why am I smoking pot randomly? Why do I want to just completely check out and play video games? And again, on the surface, my family, my friends, they would see, you know, a model employee, a model husband, a model father, right? And inside, I was beating myself up because really I was working so hard. I needed an outlet. I needed a channel to let go. And unfortunately, I chose a channel like getting out and getting drunk. And I wasn't driving. I learned that lesson the hard way from the tree incident, but I'd still take an Uber and I would not remember what I do, or I'd be sick and completely unproductive the next day because I couldn't get out of bed. And I'm like, I am going to be 40. What the hell am I thinking? And now it's almost to the point where I'm so aware of it that if I go out with my friends and I have a couple glasses of wine, no big deal. But I purposely, when we go out with buddies or go celebrate, I won't take Ubers. I will be the designated driver and I'll go have a beer or hang out, but I will drive because I don't necessarily fully trust myself still, where I can put myself in situations where, you know, it's right in front of me and you know, knowing that I don't have to drive or I'm out in front. For me, it's really just, it's so important to love yourself and forgive yourself and know yourself. And I just never had gotten to that point until I started going to therapy. And what I realized is, you know what? I'm not perfect. So what? Maybe I'm not getting drunk every weekend. Maybe it's you know, having a couple drinks once every 90 days, but I'm not going to beat myself up. I'm not going to go to extremes and saying I'm never going to do this again, because then it's like, if you mess up, you like, you can't forgive yourself. So just know your limits, know your boundaries, be soft and tender with yourself. And ultimately, you know, you're, as long as you do good most of the time, it's okay to have other outlets. So what I'm really working on now is just like finding other outlets, like snowboarding and, you know, running and just other ways to kind of get that pent up aggression out, yeah. That pent up, because you got to let it out somewhere. The top performers, if you keep it all in, if you're all working, it's going to come out somewhere. It's going to burst from the seam. So it's finding healthy ways to let it out that are in alignment with who you are.
So important for people to hear, especially for top performers. I think that, like, I mean, I've shared with you some of my story too, and listeners will probably hear more about it as we continue. But, you know, like, that was how it was for me for like a long time. It was just like, even at a young age, it was like 8 years of just like grinding and like over, you know, 5, 6, 7 years of like, if you're a top performer, and this is the, like, if you're an athlete, if you are, I don't know, a musician, if you're, you know, in business, but if you just work, like eventually, like, you start ignoring things that are happening inside your body, ignoring emotions, ignoring things that you've kind of pushed away for a really long time. And if you don't allow those emotions or feelings or have an outlet to get some of those things out, like, they're just going to get bigger and bigger, and you're going to run into some bigger problems, yeah. when they eventually, because they will find their way out in one way, shape, or form or the other.
And your circumstances aren't your fault, right? If you're born into a family where you struggle with abuse or something's happened to you, that's not your fault, right? You determine your future, right? You can't, if you hold on to the past and your story is the past, you're never going to move forward and become the person you were meant to be. So for me, it's really just understanding and knowing, okay, there's some addiction in my family. Like, this is not your fault. If you want to go out and you know, sometimes this is, you know, genetic, yeah. Right? So just really just driving, you know, from a place of compassion and understanding, like, you know, that there's sometimes those forces that are a little outside your control. You can do the best with what you have, and, you know, and that's really, for me, been the most liberating thing in the world. And what therapy taught me is, like, you're not perfect, dude. Give yourself a pat on the back, man. You've done really, really well. You're setting an example. You're doing your best. And I feel so good, but nobody is perfect. I don't care who you are, like the model family that you see, that there's something going on with everyone. So I think, you know, the key is just make sure that you trust yourself and you know yourself, and ultimately that you take action, that you live in alignment with your core values and who you are, versus just, you know, saying and doing one thing on the outside, but then keeping secrets. You never want to be in a place where you're keeping secrets. And that's kind of why I'm sharing some of this with you, is, you know, if I can't share like my ups and downs, the good and bad, like, I'm not relatable, right? So just making sure that we all know. And in sales, it's such a culture of work hard, party hard. It's almost
work,
like,
hard, play hard. Yeah.
Work hard, play hard. It's almost like ingrained into us, and it's just not the right way. It's like, sell with purpose, like, use your gifts for service, and share, you know, share what you have with others to make them better, whether it's your customers, whether it's your team. That is so much more fulfilling than work hard, than spend your money on material things and party it away. That's how I was living for so long, and it's just been so wonderful since getting married and having a son, and now kind of entering this next journey of my life, which is about love and service and just helping people.
Ian, so much love for your brother. Thank you so much for taking out your time to be on the show, man. It's been a pleasure having you. If people want to connect with you or find you, what's the best, what platforms are you on?
Yeah, I am full-time Salesforce. It's my love and my passion. So I'm doing this to help, really, truly to help and serve other people who can get value from my story. So if you have any questions, you want to reach out, the best way to get a hold of me is, I'm on LinkedIn, Ian Koniak, IanKoniak. You can connect with me there, or on Facebook, or just email me if you want to have a one-on-one conversation. It's ianconiak@gmail.com.
Awesome, Ian. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, Andrew.